Welcome to the KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. In this episode, we have local alerts and updates, followed by a special interview on the humanitarian situation in Gaza, including impacts of an upcoming Israeli Supreme Court decision. This is KMUD News. Starting off in Fortuna. The Humboldt County Department of Public Works will be conducting a resurfacing project on Sunny Heights Road in Fortuna beginning Monday, August 24th through Friday, August 28th. Road crews will begin paving on Sunny Heights Road, starting near the Carson Woods Road intersection and continuing to the end of the county-maintained section. Work will take place from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Travelers are to expect one-hour delays and are asked to drive slowly, follow all traffic control devices and road signs in the project area. Thank you for your patience while repair work is in progress. If you have any concerns or questions regarding the project, please call 707-445-7421. An update on the Milepost 18 fire in Hoopa Valley. As of this broadcast recording, in the late afternoon of Thursday, August 13th, the MP18 fire is estimated at 3,973 acres with 6% containment. Route 96, from 3.9 miles east to 8.3 miles east of Hoopa, is closed due to fire activity. Avoid the area and plan alternate routes. Next is an alleged case of arson in Hoopa unrelated to the current MP18 fire. On August 8th at approximately 5:07 p.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to a residence in the 1900 block of Pine Creek Road in Hoopa for a report of a physical altercation between two male subjects. Upon arrival, deputies intervened in the altercation and detained 52-year-old Hoopa resident Aaron James Pohl. According to witness statements, Pohl had arrived at the residence and refused to leave the property. Prior to the altercation, witnesses reported seeing Pohl near the Hoopa Rodeo Grounds and the River Bar, where a small vegetation fire was burning. Witnesses reported that Pohl was attempting to accelerate the spread of the fire with his hands. The fire was quickly extinguished by the Kurok Fire Department, which had been staged at the Hoopa Wildland Fire Department. While Hoopa Wildland Fire personnel were actively engaged in firefighting operations on the Milepost 18 fire. Based on witness statements and evidence collected during the investigation, Pohl was arrested and transported to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where he was booked on the following charges: arson, obstructing or resisting a peace officer, assault, and bench warrant/failure to appear. The Sheriff's Office has also received reports of other suspected arson fires in the Hoopa Valley. From the Humboldt Community Organizations Active in Disaster, Humboldt COAD has received an urgent resource request to support air quality needs in the Hoopa Valley community, which is currently impacted by the Milepost 18 fire. An evacuation order and multiple evacuation warnings are still in effect, and heavy smoke is significantly affecting air quality throughout the valley, including for elders, children, and residents with respiratory conditions. The following items are requested for immediate distribution: air scrubbers, 10 units, commercial-grade, potable HEPA air scrubbers, approximately 500-plus CFM, suitable for large rooms and community spaces. Box fans, standard 20-inch by 20-inch units, and they need 100 units. MERV-13 or higher filters, and they need 200 of those filters. Duct tape, 60 rolls. As many N95 respirators as folks can provide. The box fans, filters, and duct tape will be used to assemble DIY box fan air filtration units for homes in the impacted area. If you want to donate some of these items, you can email Nick, N-I-C-K, at HumboldtCOAD.org. That's Nick at HumboldtCOAD.org. And up next, a special on the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA, This is KMUD News. Israel's Supreme Court has begun hearing arguments in a legal challenge to laws restricting the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. The petition was filed by human rights organizations on behalf of Palestinian refugee families. It challenges two laws enacted in October 2024 and a third measure passed in December of 2025. The legislation ended Israel's long-standing cooperation agreement with UNRWA, prohibited Israeli officials from communicating or coordinating with the agency, and ordered UNRWA to cease operations in areas of Israel that it considers its sovereign territory, including occupied East Jerusalem. Supporters of the laws say they are intended to prevent perpetuation of Palestinian refugee status, reinforce Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, and respond to allegations that some UNRWA employees participated in the October 7th attacks. UNRWA was established by the United Nations General Assembly in 1949 and began operating the following year. After Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem in 1967, Israel signed an agreement committing it to facilitate UNRWA's work. The agency operates schools and health centers and provides food, water, shelter, medical care, and other assistance to Palestinian refugees. It has also played a central role in humanitarian operations in Gaza, where the delivery of aid has required coordination with the Israeli military. To learn more about the legal challenge, the allegations against UNRWA, and what is at stake if the agency is unable to continue its work in the occupied Palestinian territories, KPFA's Lauren Schmidt spoke with Roland Frederic, director of UNRWA Affairs in the West Bank. He spoke about the agency's history, the allegations made against UNRWA, and what comes next in the legal challenge.
UNRWA was established more than 70 years ago as a short-term agency to support Palestinian refugees through services, through work, through humanitarian aid, until a solution to the plight, a fair and just solution to the plight is found. Unfortunately, because there has been no political solution to the Palestinian refugee issue, which of course is one of the key issues of the Middle East conflict and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because there has been no solution, UNRWA is still there. We have a mandate from the UN General Assembly that is renewed every 3 years, most recently in December last year, supported by 151 member states. And we have a mandate to provide services, public sector-like services, to registered Palestinian refugees, but also humanitarian aid in case the situation demands that. What does it mean concretely? In the West Bank, we provide education, healthcare, social protection, but also infrastructure and garbage collection services to more than 1.1 million beneficiaries. Roughly a quarter live in 19 refugee camps on the ground in very difficult socioeconomic conditions. So through these critical services, we make sure that children can go to school. We have more than 90 schools in the West Bank. We have more than 50 health facilities in the West Bank, but we also provide social protection and of course, psychosocial support. We also have a microfinance program. So it's a broad array of services. In Gaza, our footprint is even bigger. We have 11,000 staff in Gaza. Equally, before 7th of October and the Hamas attacks and the beginning of the war, we provided the same services, education, healthcare, social protection, also employment generation, municipal-like services. But since the 7th of October war, of course, the focus in Gaza has fully shifted to emergency assistance. So that means we run shelters, we provide emergency education, we make sure that garbage gets picked up, and we also do a lot of psychosocial support and actually even shelter. At the moment, we have more than 80 shelters where Palestinian refugees have sought refuge, and we will provide them with a roof over their head in a very horrible situation on the ground.
For decades, UNRWA operated under an agreement with Israel that required Israeli authorities to facilitate the agency's work. That relationship, however, has changed dramatically. Israel has now terminated that agreement and barred its officials from communicating or coordinating with UNRWA. Can you explain where the relationship between UNRWA and Israel stands today and what those changes mean for your ability to operate?
What is important to understand, of course, that the UNRWA is a UN agency. We're part of the UN system. That means we always operate in coordination, cooperation with member states. And in that case, of course, also the state of Israel, either sort of as the state on the ground, Israeli authorities within the sovereign territory of the state of Israel, or indeed sort of as the occupying power in the occupied Palestinian territory. And before the 7th of October, we had effective relationships, as any UN agency, any humanitarian agency across the world is dependent upon when working in emergency situations. That means we had regular technical coordination with the Israeli military, with the Israeli government, as any UN agency. What has happened over the last 2 years is that Israel has adopted a series of laws to curtail the activity of UNRWA. There is one law that bans UNRWA's activities within the sovereign territory of the state of Israel, which from Israel's perspective includes occupied East Jerusalem. Occupied East Jerusalem is generally internationally understood as occupied, and that is where our main headquarters was based, in addition to 6 schools and 2 health facilities for roughly 90,000 Palestinian refugees residing in occupied East Jerusalem. So that's where Israel proceeded to ban our work. Second law that was introduced roughly a year and a half ago banned Israeli authorities from having contact with UNRWA. And that impacts our work in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip because we do depend, of course, on coordination with all actors on the ground, and particularly Israeli military, to bring life-saving aid to the people and to make sure that people are safe when we provide that aid and that our own staff is safe. If you don't have that coordination, it's much more dangerous for our staff to work, and it impairs our ability to provide that assistance on the ground. And then thirdly, late last year, a third law was introduced that cuts water and electricity from UNRWA facilities in East Jerusalem, equally provides for the seizure of our main headquarters and a vocational training center in occupied East Jerusalem, and also removes the applicability under Israeli law of the privileges and immunities of the United Nations to UNRWA. And these are all rather unprecedented measures because in the end, there is applicable international law. And we believe that these measures taken against the agency stand in contravention of these international legal frameworks. And that's, by the way, also what the International Court of Justice has established last October, namely that Israel as a member state has an obligation to facilitate humanitarian aid of the United Nations, including that of UNRWA, an obligation to protect United Nations staff on the ground, including staff of UNRWA, and also an obligation to respect the privileges and immunities, the diplomatic privileges and immunities of UNRWA as a UN agency. That is not what we're seeing at the moment. But we do hope that in the future there will be a way to reestablish a functioning an effective relationship between Israel as a member state of the United Nations and UNRWA, in the interest, by the way, of everybody who lives in that part of the world, Palestinian refugees, Palestinians writ large, but of course also Israeli citizens.
The Israeli Supreme Court is now hearing arguments in a petition brought by Adala and other human rights organizations challenging these laws. While UNRWA itself did not file the lawsuit, are you in touch with the legal team, and is there anything you can share about the proceedings and the effort to overturn these laws, which I believe took effect in January?
UNRWA, as a UN agency, does not engage in domestic court proceedings. So UNRWA is not party to those proceedings. And I understand that the organizations who brought the proceedings did so in the name of a number of Palestinian refugees who believe that their rights are being infringed upon. What I can say is that indeed the impact of the Israeli legislation on UNRWA's work on the ground has been palpable. That there's no doubt about it. Our main headquarters in East Jerusalem was destroyed and razed and seized in January this year. Last year, six of our schools in occupied East Jerusalem were forcibly closed, with the result that roughly 800 children did lose access to quality education. Also, at two health centers in occupied East Jerusalem, with roughly 30,000 beneficiaries. These centers also were forcibly closed, and water and electricity were cut off in January this year. That means the patients who used to come for us also cannot come to get these services anymore. And a lot of them, by the way, in East Jerusalem have no alternative means. So it means that these people find it much more difficult now to get access to quality medical services. And that, of course, has an impact. That is a direct result of those laws. And what I should also add is that, generally speaking, public service in the West Bank, in particular those of the Palestinian authorities, are under a lot of pressure. Financial pressure, movement and access restrictions, Palestinian Authority not being able to pay salaries for most of its staff. That means the PA services are also crumbling. And in such a situation, we normally see more people coming to our health centers. In fact, last year, we did a record number of health consultations in the West Bank, 1.1 million. And that is a result of a number of factors, but partly it is a result of increasing pressure, political, financial, on the Palestinian Authority. And in such a situation, we need to be able to bring in medication from the outside without any hindrance. That is not possible anymore because of the no-contact policy. So while on the one hand we have more demand for health service, on the other hand we can't get the medication as quickly as we would need it on the ground, and we need to rely on other mechanisms that more cost-effective and less efficient. That is another impact of those laws. So yes, what I can say, there has been a palpable impact, and even more than so in the West Bank. Even it's the case in the Gaza Strip. Because in the Gaza Strip, UNRWA is not allowed to bring in supplies as UNRWA. We continue to operate in the Gaza Strip, 11,000 staff, 60,000 health consultations per week. I mentioned educational support before. We do still half of the drinking water distribution in Gaza Strip. It's done by UNRWA. And we do all of that without the ability to bring in food, nutrition, medical supplies. So we have to rely on partners. That is a direct result of the Israeli laws that ban UNRWA from bringing life-saving aid into the Gaza Strip, and that is simply not the way to deal with such a humanitarian crisis, particularly because we remain by far the biggest humanitarian organization on the ground. So yes, there are a number of impacts when it comes to the Israeli legislation, also in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Israel has justified these laws in part by pointing to allegations that some UNRWA employees participated in the October 7th attacks. Meanwhile, Abdallah has characterized the broader claims against the agency as vague, unsubstantiated, and politically motivated. I know UNRWA did terminate some employees following the allegations, but can you walk us through how UNRWA responded and what measures the agency took to investigate and address them?
What I can explain is a little bit of what happened in the nature of these allegations. In early 2024, we received news from the Israeli government that 19 UNRWA employees would have allegedly participated in the terrorist attack of 7th of October. The Commissioner General at the time took a decision to immediately terminate these staff members because of the severity of the allegations. What followed then was an independent investigation by the UN Secretariat in New York, who asked for corroborating evidence from the Israeli authorities, didn't receive an awful lot, and then reached the conclusion that if they had been given appropriate evidence, these allegations could have been corroborated in the case of nine employees who were among those terminated from service, out of, at the time, I think 14,000. Let me be very clear. There is no room in UNRWA or another UN agency for people who do not share the value of the United Nations, who are engaged in terrorist or criminal activity. That's very clear. We have mechanisms to deal with that. Now, at the same time, UNRWA launched an independent process to review its neutrality procedures. It was a commission with international experts chaired by the former French Foreign Minister, Catherine Colonna. That the commission came to the conclusion that UNRWA has good mechanisms to deal with neutrality issues, particularly given the very difficult context in which we work, but that more can be done. And that led then to an action plan with 50 recommendations. 41 are now being have been implemented. on issues such as strengthening screening of staff and vetting of staff, even more work to ensure neutrality of installations, additional ethics and internal oversight mechanisms, and so on and so forth. And one thing we've been always very clear about it, if there's any evidence, any allegations that staff of Wundershall engage in activities that they're prohibited from doing so, then we need to have that information to be able to take action. What makes it very difficult is on the one end to be sort of confronted with allegations of very severe nature, openly and publicly, and then being denied the ability to address those allegations as part of a proper dialogue between a UN agency and a member state. That is a very difficult position to be in. I cannot comment on whatever other motivation might be behind these allegations, because not just allegations, you also see a dedicated campaign to discredit UNRWA and its reputation in a number of countries. And mind you, we have five different fields of operation that are independent and very, very different. The Gaza Strip situation is very different from Jordan. The operation in Lebanon is very different from the West Bank, and so on and so forth.
If the Israeli Supreme Court ultimately rejects this petition, what comes next? And are there other legal avenues available through international bodies such as the International Court of Justice? And finally, as the United Nations General Assembly prepares to gather in New York next month, what is your message to the people in the United States and elsewhere who want to demonstrate their support for UNRWA and for Palestinian refugees?
Well, I think the key thing is that we need to end violence, and we need to end suffering in this part of the world. There's been way too much suffering for the people of Gaza, way too much suffering for people in Israel, and way too much suffering for people in Lebanon and Syria and other places. We are a technical, a humanitarian, a development agency. We have a role to play to help people in need, and we have a role to play when it comes to maintaining stability in the region. And I would encourage all of those who listen to or hear statements on UNRWA to ask for facts, to engage in constructive discussion, and to form their own opinion. We have a very clear position, what we are doing, why we are doing it, and we have nothing to hide. So in that sense, I would invite everybody to critically look at any allegations brought against the agency.
And Roland, thank you so much for joining us again. And really quickly, what comes next? Again, whether the court rejects or approves this petition.
I think the proceedings is something that the complainants will have to look at. What I can say is that the International Court of Justice has already clearly stated that there is an obligation by all parties, including the State of Israel, to support and facilitate the work of all humanitarian actors, including UNRWA. And we do hope that the Israeli authorities will heed these rulings of the court. And we're ready to work with them.
That was Roland Frederic, Director of UNRWA Affairs in the West Bank, speaking with KPFA's Lauren Schmidt about the legal challenge to Israeli laws restricting the UN agency's operations in the occupied Palestinian territories. UNRWA provides Palestinian refugees with healthcare, education, food, water, and other essential services. Services now threatened by new laws pending a decision from Israel's Supreme Court. Here are the current Caltrans road conditions and advisories for our region.
This is a Caltrans Sister Juan road information bulletin for Humboldt County State Highways for the week beginning Friday, August 14th. On 36, slide removal continues west of Grizzly Creek Redwood State Park. Check Caltrans Sister Juan social media for updates. Expect delays west of Maple Grove at the Little Larrabee Creek Bridge and at the Butte Creek Bridge. On 96, expect delays north of Willow Creek, and fire response continues north of Hoopaw. Check social media for updates. On 101, expect up to 10-minute delays north of the Mendocino County line. Expect delays north of Oreck and near the Del Norte County line. On 254, expect delays north of Wyatt. On 299, expect up to 10-minute delays east of Blue Lake. This is a Caltrans Sister Juan road information bulletin for Del Norte County State Highways for the week beginning Friday, August 14th. On 101, expect up to 20-minute delays at various locations from Klamath to north of Last Chance Grade and near Hamilton Road on the 21st. On 197, expect up to 10-minute delays near Jenny Lane. On 199, expect up to 20-minute delays near Blue Slide and the Middle Fork Smith River Bridge. This is a Caltrans Sister Guan Road Information Bulletin for Lake of Mendocino County State Highways for the week beginning Friday, August 14th. In Lake County on 20, expect delays west of Upper Lake in Lucerne, Clear Lake Oaks, and east of Route 53. On 175, expect delays south of Route 29 and near Middletown. And in Mendocino County on 1, expect delays at various locations from north of Schooner Gulch Road to north of Elk. Expect delays at the Jack Peters Creek Bridge on the 19th. Expect up to 15-minute delays south of Westport at the Blues Beach Trailhead to the Overlook. Expect delays at the Wages Creek Bridge and near the Juan Creek Bridge. On 20, expect delays east of Fort Bragg, west of the Three Chop Road and in Willits. On 101, expect overnight delays in Hopland and near Nelson Ranch Road. On 162, expect up to 10-minute delays from east of US 101 to south of Covelo. For further updates, join us on social media via Caltrans District 1.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Biana Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. KMUD News is now on streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Sinkione, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.